Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. The music you are listening to is Helwa Ya Balidi by Palestinian vocalist Lina Sleeby. 110 years ago tomorrow, the state of Utah executed labor activist, songwriter, and wobbly Joe Hill on trumped-up charges that led to a conviction of murder. It is widely believed that he was targeted for his labor activism. To honor his memory, we're going to close our show today with the Ballad of Joe Hill, written and sung by Phil Oakes. For the remainder of the hour, we're focusing on the ongoing genocidal wars in the Middle East and their impact on stateside civil rights. Norm Diamond reviews a novel by Palestinian Isabella Hamad called Enter Ghost, which brings into stark relief the daily experience of Palestinians living in the West Bank under the Israeli-enforced apartheid regime. To begin our show, Denise Morris interviews co-directors Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth about their new documentary, The Palestine Exception. In the film, Jan and Jennifer pull the curtain back on the long-held ban on criticism of Israeli policy, particularly within academia. It's okay on campus to raise questions about anything, just not Palestine. Thus, the Palestine exception to free speech and academic freedom. The film debuts Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m. in Lincoln Hall at Portland State University. The screening is followed by a panel and is free and open to the public. If there is a theme to our show this morning, it's that film, literature, theater, and song are fundamental to our capacity to resist and envision a better world. Before we get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO depends on the support of listeners like you. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. The KBOO community thanks you. Now, here is Denise Morris with Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth.
I've been struck by how brave many of the student activists and their supporters have been in sustaining over the course of a year these actions on campuses in the face of enormous repression, including police actions against students, violent disruption or demolishing of encampments on campuses. And I think it was important for us to tell the story of that, how campuses have a long history of being sites of both rebellion or resistance and also massive repression. So the film tells some of the story of college campuses that are often sites of military research as well as knowledge production that sustains, in this case, the interests of pro-Israeli organizations like AIPAC and other groups that have been very important in marginalizing the Justice for Palestine movement.
That was Jan Hocken talking about the new documentary film, The Palestine Exception. This week, on Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m., folks will have an opportunity to see The Palestine Exception. It is a new documentary film directed by Portland-based filmmakers Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth. It will screen in Lincoln Hall at Portland State University. This event is free and open to the public and will be followed by a panel discussion. Detailed information can be found on the PSU website. Quote, after years of right-wing assaults on higher education, attacks took a new form in 2023 and 2024 that has been described as the new McCarthyism. As students across the country organized protests against Israel's war on Gaza, decades-long taboos against academia around criticism of Israel, the Palestine exception, are shattered. I spoke with the filmmakers about the Palestine Exception Project and their hopes and plans for screening and distribution. Jan Hocken is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Portland State University, a clinical psychologist and award-winning documentary filmmaker, as well as a longtime member of the Old Mole Collective. Jennifer Ruth is a professor in the School of Film and an associate dean in the College of the Arts at Portland State University.
Good morning, Jan and Jennifer. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to congratulate you both and the crew. The Palestine Exception is a terrific film, and it should not go unrecognized that this documentary was filmed and completed in a timeline that's allowing it to be a part of the ongoing struggle. And I know that couldn't have been an easy task. I hope people will get out and see this film. And so as someone who has spent a lot of time in the last year expanding on my own understanding of the history, the broader history of the region and the decades-long struggle for Palestine liberation, I appreciated this film. And I felt like there was an intimacy in how the story is told. And I think that's really fitting for a film about the rich history and struggle of a people which can't be told without consequences. So I thought we could start there and have you tell us about the Palestine Exception film.
Well, it basically follows tells a story of the largest anti-war movement on college campuses since the early 1970s. And there have been images both of the ongoing genocide in Gaza that have captured the news over the last year, but also images of the campus protests across the country and across the world that have captured interest, but often very fleeting and in ways that are often confusing for people to understand who aren't part of this movement or don't have a strong identification with the Justice for Palestine movement. So we started this film from where we are here in Portland, Oregon, following groups here, but also interviewing scholars, particularly activist scholars around the country, who are reflecting on and trying to help people understand what's at stake in these protests and this movement itself. And I think often documentaries play an important role in helping people hold in mind and hold a bigger picture and a broader analysis than they would have certainly in the fleeting images and commentary in mainstream media. Jennifer, do you want to add something about that and also why it's called the Palestine Exception?
Sure. I'd long been familiar with this phrase, the Palestine Exception to Academic Freedom and Free Speech. And even though I got a PhD in literature and I taught in a literature department and I now teach in a film department, academic freedom and its history and its various struggles around it has actually been a focus for me for my whole career. I first started looking at adjunct faculty and contingency and what that means in terms of having a strong shared governance between faculty and administrators. So I looked at various things and I'd kind of put off learning about the Palestine Exception, even though I was very familiar with it, because I knew it would take a deep dive, because academic freedom is our ability to look into something deeply enough with the skills that we've learned, the training that we have, ultimately to have a judgment, to make judgments, right? Academic freedom is not free speech in the sense that free speech is where you're allowed to utter your opinion, uninformed or informed, right? Academic freedom is the freedom to really do the deep dives and then actually have a judgment. So I had put off doing that. And then, of course, last year, I no longer could. I did that work, and then Jan and I had already been talking about doing a film around the attack on higher education, the right-wing attempts to delegitimize professors and students as woke and indoctrinated, the attacks on critical race theory, and the so-called divisive concepts legislation. We'd already been talking about working on a documentary around those attacks on academic freedom, and then after October 7th, we pivoted to this, and I quickly experienced the intimidation on my own campus, the Palestine Exception, the attempts to silence and suppress the scholarship, the history around Palestine.
Jan, do you want to say something more about what led you to take up this project and how you both came together?
Yeah, all of my documentary films have focused on marginalized or repressed history, people whose experiences or modes of analysis have been marginalized, and have sought to bring them in through the medium of a documentary, but not just to celebrate or to honor lost or repressed histories, but also to learn from them how people have been able to sustain themselves in the face of tremendous violence and oppression. And so for me, in the course of carrying out this project, it was an effort to try to, as Jennifer said, to try to understand what this newest phase of the Justice for Palestine movement is about, why so many young activists identify with the Justice in Palestine cause, how it relates to the fight against genocide and the call for a ceasefire, or also calls for a different kind of world and challenging settler colonialism and the militarism that the US has supported, particularly in its support of Israel. My interest also has been in broadening and supporting this movement. And I think of my documentaries as a form of cultural work, a way of helping to hold the stories and modes of analysis that have been pushed aside or repressed. Certainly, the Palestine exception is a vivid example of that, a whole history of people not only in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territories, but in the diaspora, whose perspectives, histories, and stories and trauma have been excluded from the dominant narratives, including in much of academia.
Jan and Jennifer, can you talk about how the focus of the film shifted over the course of the year that you followed the protests and the Justice for Palestine movement?
I've been struck by how brave many of the student activists and their supporters have been in sustaining over the course of a year these actions on campuses, including the encampments in the spring, in the face of enormous repression, including police actions against students and violent disruption or demolishing of encampments on campuses. And I think it was important for us to tell the story of that, how campuses have a long history, college campuses of being sites of both rebellion or resistance and also massive repression. So the film tells some of the story of college campuses that are often, of course, sites of military research and as well as knowledge production that sustains, in this case, the interests of pro-Israeli organizations like AIPAC and other groups that have been very important in marginalizing the Justice for Palestine movement.
Yeah, and I would just add that over the course of the year, one of the challenges was how quickly this issue got co-opted and there were new alliances made between pro-Israeli Jewish groups in the US and right-wing groups that had already been delegitimizing higher education. And so one of the focuses that ended up being an important thread of the film is the weaponization of anti-Semitism to suppress speech on behalf of Palestine, or even speech calling for an end of genocide or ceasefire, right? In the fear of being labeled anti-Semitic. So the weaponization wasn't just the narratives that make one worry that one will be considered anti-Semitic if one speaks about, the tens of thousands. You take the UN account, 44,000 dead, another 10, 12,000 unaccounted for, and many, many 100,000 expected to die of famine, even if the war stopped now. And those are the numbers are a lot of people think actually higher. But if you're trying to criticize Israel for this action, it considers itself Jewish and democratic, but it's How are you democratic when only half of your citizens, the Jewish citizens, have full rights? So it wasn't just the fear of pointing those things out and being called anti-Semitic, but there was actually the Department of Education, the Office of Civil Rights, and Congress itself, with Virginia Fox and Elise Stefanik, were investigating schools and demanding that they release records around discrimination. And they were using discrimination laws in order to intimidate and to almost insist that administrators take a very hard line with any speech that seems critical of Israel. And administrators complied. They very much complied. And so, realizing the degree to which the movement to try and stop a genocide, which is exactly what, we think we're teaching our students to do, and it is one of the primary lessons of the Holocaust, is to speak up when you believe that a genocide is being perpetrated. So the students were doing exactly what we'd hope them to do, and the repression was so swift, and the narratives were so Orwellian and hard to unpack. So tracing those narratives became a big focus of the film for us, because you have to unpack those narratives to disable them and to continue to have the courage to speak up.
It was really a challenge to watch some of that unfold, particularly the arrogance of the Congress people and the sadness at watching these academics fold around that. And so I really appreciated the film for its ability to do exactly what you just said, to try to unpack all of this and try to understand what becomes at stake for actually speaking out. Going to lose their jobs anyway, right? Yeah.
Exactly. The
Presidents of some of the top universities in this country. Yeah.
Right,
Of
exactly.
course, if presidents of Columbia, MIT, and Harvard are brought down, public university presidents are also more vulnerable. And so we've seen that all over the country, where administrators are very worried about their boards, their donors, and there's a long history of this kind of cracking down, and including the history of McCarthyism. And in some ways, this is different, but has the echo of McCarthyism that we take up in the film as well.
In our last couple of minutes, I wanted to ask you, what are your hopes for this film, plans for distribution, and how has the Trump victory affected that horizon for screenings and for protest?
The film is 70 minutes, which is pretty long, but still allows time for a panel following the screening at Portland State on the 21st that will be moderated by Stephanie Wahab, who's in the film briefly, and Ted Khoury, who will be joining us. Okay, and Sena Dilsai, who's also a PSU student, Palestinian, who's featured in the film. So a big aim for screenings that are already being scheduled around the country is to use this space we have in academia that we still need to fiercely protect for academic freedom, for discussion and analysis, and organizing strategies for moving ahead. And so the panel here will hopefully be similar to panels at screenings elsewhere, where the film is an opening for discussion and reflection and ideas about how to move ahead and how to resist.
So the election on November 5th really raises the stakes. It was already a hard climate to begin with. The Palestine exception is a bipartisan exception, and both groups are very vulnerable to lobbying and U.S. interests being perceived to be identical with supporting Israel. But nonetheless, it just got a lot harsher. Because Trump said things like, if student protesters who were not US citizens were found to break the law, which we know will now be a very expansive concept of what it means to break the law in demonstrations, they will be deported. Stefanik, who was one of the lead and most aggressive persecutors of the college presidents, will be the UN ambassador. Mike Huckabee, who is a Christian Zionist, will be the ambassador to Israel. Steve Witzcott will be an envoy. All of these people do not believe that Palestinians even exist, and they are for a greater Israel only for Jewish people. So Trump has been stressing that he's going to be about peace. The problem is he doesn't care about justice. So it's going to be peace through killing, through mass killing and the total disenfranchisement of all Palestinians. So it's a terrifying, terrifying notion, and it will mean more repression around speaking on this and more criminalizing of speaking about this and being courageous enough to unpack the narratives.
Well, thank you both for joining the Old Mole this morning. And I'll let folks know again when and where they can see the film. Good luck out there.
Thanks,
Thank
Denise.
you.
I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I was speaking with Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth about their new documentary film, The Palestine Exception. On Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m., The Palestine Exception will screen in Lincoln Hall at Portland State University. The event is free and open to the public and will be followed by a panel discussion. You can find detailed information about the event on the Portland State University website. Thanks for joining us.
ينقص في سلاحف بحرية يقتل حيوانات بشرية تلك قضية وتلك قضية كيف تكون ملاكا أبيض يبقى ضميرك نص ضمير تنصف حركات الحرية تنسف حركات التحرير وتوزع عطفك وحنانك عالمقتول حسب الجنسية وتلك قضية وتلك قضية كيف تكون إنسانا راقيا.
That music was Tel Kadea by Kairoki, an Egyptian band who wrote the song as a tribute to the Palestine Freedom Movement. Before that, Denise Morris was speaking with Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth about their film, The Palestine Exception. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. What role might be played in political struggle by cultural creations? A new novel, Interghost, by Isabel Hamad, raises this question doubly, both as a novel set in current struggles and in the story it recounts about the contested effort to mount a theater production in Palestine's West Bank. With some help from Shakespeare, Norm Diamond reviews the novel.
I expected them to interrogate me at the airport, and they did. That is the strong opening line to a new novel by Isabella Hamad. Knowing the author is Palestinian, the line immediately situates us in a larger and fraught context. The they referred to as the interrogators must be Israeli officials, and the Palestinian protagonist is seeking to enter or re-enter Israel. The novel's name is Enter Ghost. Enter Ghost, too, is the stage direction in Shakespeare's Hamlet each time the dead king appears. Is the woman entering Israel a ghost? And even as a live person, to whom might she be a ghost? In the novel, a Palestinian theater troupe seeks to mount a production of Hamlet in the West Bank. So there's to be a play within the novel, just as there's a play within the play in Hamlet. Will this be the play, as Hamlet says, to catch the conscience of a king? Or will Israeli authorities seek to block the production? And can they? Some of those are questions of plot, of storytelling, for the reader to answer. And read this outstanding novel is something I hope you do. Our more immediate question, though, is why choose Hamlet to perform for a Palestinian audience? Is the audience not only the fictional occupants of the West Bank who might attend the play, but also the readers of Hamad's novel? Enter Ghost, terrific as it is in plot, in character development, in psychological insight, is also a way of alerting its readers to the slings and arrows, to quote Hamlet, the slings and arrows of daily life for Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank. Those daily hardships and humiliations are not often told in the West, in the fairy tale version we're fed of Israel as a democracy, supposedly for all its inhabitants, and the general silence about the additional territory it controls. The novel might say to its readers, as Shakespeare did, "Let us once again assail your ears that are so fortified against our story." The actors in Enter Ghost glom onto the famous line in Hamlet, "Something is rotten in the state of Denmark." But in place of this mythical Denmark, they hear what theatergoers in many countries for many centuries have heard, their own country, or the country that rules over them, in this case, Israel. Or there's that other reference in Hamlet that resonates with the way Israel presents its policies about Palestinians to the world. "That one may smile and smile and be a villain, at least I'm sure it may be so in Denmark." But Exposé of Oppression is insufficient by itself. Shakespeare's Hamlet is about action and what holds us back from taking action. For a Palestinian audience, these words from Hamlet's famous "to be or not to be" monologue might resonate. "Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them." Could presenting Hamlet in the West Bank be a prompt to Palestinian activism? Would the play be perceived that way, as a threat by Israeli authorities? Would they really shut down Shakespeare? On the one hand, Hamlet, the character, dithers, intellectualizes, forgoes opportunities to act, fulminates, but continues to put up with the situation he finds intolerable. As Shakespeare has him reflect, "Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought in enterprises of great pitch and moment. With this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action." On the other hand, Hamlet also says, "Now could I drink hot blood and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on." Shakespeare's play, of course, ends with action, literally taking arms against a sea of troubles, but with unforeseen and tragic consequences, perhaps foreshadowing the ambiguity of Hamad's ending to her novel. We'll get to that. But maybe we've not been asking the right question. Maybe the Palestinian intention and the potential Israeli response aren't focused on Hamlet specifically. Maybe they have more to do with the effort to create an institution, in this case a theater company, in the West Bank, or even an institution linking Palestinians in the West Bank and inside Israel, or to create occasions for Palestinian gatherings. Israeli rule is partly predicated on keeping Palestinians divided. In the novel, funding for new institutions, even through NGOs, requires an Israeli stamp of approval. Electricity for the West Bank rehearsal space is selectively granted or withheld by Israeli authorities. And the janitor who opens or blocks access to the space is a Palestinian on the Israeli payroll, lurking for hints of undeclared funding or any political ties. In that case, the very intention of putting on a play, or a few people gathering in a room to consider that possibility, or to rehearse, is inherently a political act. And that's an aspect of Palestinian life we learn from the novel, the pervasiveness of politics. As Sonia, the novel's protagonist, reminisces.
We had done the same thing every summer since I was 8, played in the garden, gone to the beach, and watched recorded footage of West Bank confrontations after dinner in the downstairs living room.
Just a normal part of Palestinian life. The family gathered around the TV, watching protests and repression. Family tensions, so common throughout the world that in most places they're not worth mentioning. Spats between spouses, jealousies between in-laws, resentments between siblings, here manifest through people's relation to the struggle. Sonia has returned to Israel to take a break from her work as an actor in London and get away from a romantic affair gone bad, also to see her older sister. It's the sister who has stayed in Israel and been more directly involved in the Palestinian struggle. Already a tension between the sisters. About her, Sonia says,
Hanin was doing it for all of us. I was committed to the cause by proxy. I didn't need, actually, to visit.
Sonia says that early. Her perspective will change. An incident from the sisters' childhood returns to force a mutual accounting. They were taken by their uncle, a doctor, from Haifa, where they live in Israel, into the West Bank to see a cousin they'd never met. The cousin had just been released from an Israeli jail after a group hunger strike. But unlike the others who'd been jailed for protesting along with him, the cousin continued to refuse food after being freed. His frail appearance and his dedication made an impression on the young Sonia, and she just assumed he recovered. Only now, on her return to Palestine as an adult, does she discover that the cousin died soon after their visit because of his continued refusal to eat, and that Hanin had known and never told her. Confronted, Hanin has no explanation. Normal, usually trivial sibling tensions here filtered through politics and the relation to struggle. That early incident contributed to Hanin's activist commitment, while it drove Sonia to swear never to return to the West Bank. It also had another kind of resonance as the family debated whether to force feed the cousin to keep him alive. The act of forcing him would have had one kind of significance when done by the family. The same act, but sometimes practiced, as we are told, by Israeli jailers, would have had another.
You are listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. The music is Helwa Ya Balidi by Palestinian singer Lena Slevy. We now return to Norm Diamond's review of Enter Ghost, a novel by Isabella Hamad.
Sonia grows politically in the course of the novel, but in subtle ways. Each encounter with a place or person brings back memories that remind her of her Palestinian roots. Staying with her sister in Haifa exposes her to the contradictions of Palestinian activism within Israeli society. For instance, the criticisms the sister receives from purer revolutionaries for holding a job within Israel, in which she tries to help fellow Palestinians. Sonia's participation in the theater group, initially reluctant, involves her in a microcosm of Palestinian society. The actors come from varied backgrounds, from inside Israel to the West Bank, from owning their own apartment in either place to living in a squalid refugee camp, from having studied abroad to never having gone more than a few miles from their birthplace. The group dynamic, as well as the prospect of putting on the play under the threat of having it banned or physically repressed, is part of what politicizes her. This is a novel for lovers of theater. We're taken inside rehearsals and see how the director, notably a woman, who herself ends up playing the role of Hamlet, works with the actors to find meaning in their parts. We hear Sonia's reflections on how she draws on real pain in her life to perform on stage, and how her lines continue to resonate after the play is over, even taking on new meaning through new experiences. We learn about the history of early Palestinian theater and its efforts to differentiate itself from the more general Arab culture, and earlier efforts to adapt Shakespeare, to make Othello an anti-colonial activist, for instance, or even to turn Hamlet's girlfriend, gentle Ophelia, into a suicide bomber. Parts of the novel are written in the form of a theater script, as in this dialogue among members of the cast beginning to find their interpretation. To begin, here's Majed.
And then, is Denmark supposed to be Palestine? Or is Denmark Israel? This time out of joint thing, something rotten in the state of Israel? I'm not being sarcastic, by the way. These are genuine questions.
Miriam.
I don't think we need to be so literal.
George.
What then about the queen, Gertrude?
Miriam.
What about the queen?
George.
I think she does symbolize Palestine.
Miriam.
And why do you think that?
George.
Because Gertrude is raped by Claudius.
Sonia.
What? Gertrude doesn't get raped.
Miriam.
Let him finish.
George.
Thank you.
Sonia.
But that's ridiculous.
George.
Gertrude is, you know, the land who gets Manhubi.
Miriam.
Looted.
George.
Like Palestine does. And like Palestine, part of her accepts this. Part of her betrays the old king, forgets what it used to be like, forgets her loyalty, like those traitors on the inside and those people who sold land to the Jews. And you know, these kinds of people, this betrayal is also the story of Palestine. It's not just we have been oppressed, it's also we have betrayed ourselves, our brothers.
Sonia.
This is a very particular reading of the play.
An underlying question in the novel, then, is about the relationship, or the possible relationship, between culture and politics. I was drawn to the novel initially by seeing that the author has a different new book directly addressing that question in the context of the Palestinian struggle. Enter Ghost is a novel, not an essay. Nevertheless, the question is foremost as the cast prepares to undertake what may be a serious risk to their professional lives and more. At one point, Sonia reflects,
"Nothing is more flattering to an artist than the illusion that he is a secret revolutionary. These public developments created a feeling among the cast that we were, in fact, preparing ourselves on a training base for an operation with a transcendental goal, that in combing our translated lines for subtext, we were fighting the odds in the name of Palestinian freedom."
But that understanding of the impact of culture is too general, too one-sided, though in remarkable circumstances, it can also be true. Here is another passage from Enter Ghost with a different perspective.
Mariam believed more sincerely than most London theater practitioners I know in a real conduit between art and politics. One night, she extemporized upon the broader risk that art might deaden resistance by softening suffering's blows through representing it. I said this was an easy statement to make when you are a citizen of a nation that granted you some of a taxpayer's privileges, even if not all of them.
She's talking there, of course, about Miriam's being a Palestinian citizen of Israel.
In any case, I wasn't sure it was true. Let people enjoy their art. What was the harm? And let them eat cake, said Mariam. Listen, you need to understand. And as she said this, she was trimming her hair over the bathroom sink, wetting it with her fingers and then combing with her left hand to extend the curls and snip. A black curl fell and separated on the white porcelain. And addressing me in the mirror, she went on to explain her theory, which she presented as truth, that when you read a novel about the occupation and feel understood, or watch a film and feel seen, your anger, which is like a wound, is dressed for a brief time, and you can go on enduring a bit more easily. And so time goes on running like an open faucet, and each film at the cultural center ends, and we applaud as the credits roll with the list of crests of institutional donors, like great European aristocratic families of old. And while there are moments in these concerts and poetry readings and lectures and plays when you might feel connected to the other people in the room, to the people behind the screen, you might feel a kind of flowering in the chest at this sight of your community's resistance embalmed in art, some beauty created out of despair. All of this means that in the end, you, or at least the middle classes, are less likely to fight the fight because despair has been relieved momentarily, and perhaps our Hamlet would just be another version of this narcotic, and what, if anything, could we do about that?
That mention of the middle classes might be the only explicit recognition of class in Enter Ghost. The novel's politics are nationalist, not class-based, with little acknowledgement of different interests or perspectives among Palestinians, except the difference between those living abroad, those in the West Bank, and those in Israel. This is understandable, of course, to the extent that Israeli imagination conceives of Palestinians as a unity, as a problem, as a non-people, as ghosts. For the cast, the stakes are heightened when one of them is served an order to show up for interrogation.
As far as I was concerned, if the Israelis really made an effort to stop us, it would not be worth the fight. We were mere human beings. There was only so much we could do. The only person who didn't look unnerved was Mariam, who stared at her actors as though, with the force of her gaze, she could make them more sturdy. I had a feeling I sometimes get when I drink too much coffee, which was that while standing still, watching Jinan and Wael, another more agitated Sonia was wriggling inside my skin, trying to get out. I was thirsty as well, and I needed the loo. And in this state of physical discomfort, something strange happened. My viewpoint switched, and as though I were in a dream and my perspective had been breached, I moved like a surveillance drone and saw our project from above, situated fragilely in time and place, this summer, this side of the wall. Accompanying this vision was a fear, almost a premonition, that it was all foretold anyway. Everything had been decided in advance. We were only acting parts that had been given to us, and now some inexorable machinery was being set in motion that would sooner or later throw our efforts out into the audience, dismantle our illusions, and leave us cowering before the faceless gods of fate and state.
But Sonia does not cower, and neither does the cast. She joins her sister at a tense demonstration at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, part of the sibling reconciliation, and the cast goes ahead with the production. There, too, relationships are transformed as a result of the fraught circumstances. Once hierarchical and director-led, the theater troupe now is a democratic collective. Hamad uses the ghost metaphor throughout. There are ghosts in Sonia's family, just as Palestinians are haunted by their past. Palestinians themselves are ghosts to Israelis, sometimes invisible presences that won't disappear and won't let themselves be disregarded. Being a ghost, too, is a third alternative to Shakespeare's limited binary, to be or not to be. The final words of the novel, as loudspeakers blare and soldiers stream around the corner and the audience tries to flee, the final words are, "Enter, ghost."
You just heard the conclusion to Norm Diamond's review of the novel Enter Ghost by Isabel Hamad. You are listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Joe Hill was a beloved member of the IWW, a songwriter and activist who is known for many of his songs, including such labor classics as The Preacher and the Slave, There is Power in a Union, and Rebel Girl. In 1914, he was convicted of a murder the evidence strongly suggests he did not commit. Tomorrow marks the 110th anniversary of his execution by the state of Utah, despite an international campaign to spare his life. On the eve of his execution, Hill called out to his fellow activists, "Don't waste time mourning, organize." Words that we would do well to heed at this moment of political peril. Phil Oakes was a songwriter and activist in the tradition of Joe Hill. His songs include "I Ain't Marchin' Anymore" and "What Are You Fightin' For?" Today, we bring you the ballad of Joe Hill, written and performed by Phil Oakes.
Here's the story of Joe Hill, who was a songwriter, came over to America from Sweden at the turn of the century, and joined the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, noted left-wing union of the times, and became sort of a minor left-wing hero. And then one day, he was accused of murder, and he became a major left-wing hero of the times. So. He was accused of murder in Utah, and you know where Utah's at. So he had to pay with his life back then, and here's a song about that, sort of like a folk ballad to the tune of John Hardy. The song, by the way, has been made into a movie starring Richard Burton as Joe Hill, and Elizabeth Taylor plays the industrial workers of the world.
Letters, he was always doing fine. In his letters, he was always doing fine. Oh, the years went by like the sun going down, slowly turned the page. And when Joe looked back at the sweat upon his tracks, he had nothing to show but his age. He had nothing to show but his age. So
he headed out for the California shore. There things were just as bad. So he joined the industrial workers of the world, 'cause the union was the only friend he had. 'Cause the union was the only friend he had. Now the strikes were bloody and the strikes were black, as hard as they were long. In the dark of the night, Joe would stay awake and write. In the morning, he would raise them with a song. In the morning, he would raise them with a song. And he wrote his words to the tunes of the day, to be passed along the union by. And the strikes were led and the songs were spread, and Joe Hill was always on the line. Yes, Joe Hill was always on the line. City, a murder was made. There was hardly food to find. Oh, the proof was poor, but the sheriff was sure that Joe was the killer of the crime. That Joe was the killer of the crime. Joe raised his hands, but they shot him down. He had nothing but guilt to give. It's a doctor I need, and they left him to bleed, but he made it 'cause he had the will to live. Yes, he made it 'cause he had the will to live. Then the trial was held in a building of wood, and there the killer would be named. And the days weighed more than the cold copper ore, 'cause he feared that he was being framed. 'Cause he found out that he was being framed. Oh, strange are the ways of the Western law. Strange are the ways of fate. For the government crawled to the mine owner's call, and the judge was appointed by the state. Yes, the judge was appointed by the state. Oh, Utah justice can be had, but not for a union man. And Joe was warned by some early morn, there'd be one less singer in the land. There'd be one less singer in the land. Now William Spry was Governor Spry, and life was his to hold. On the last appeal fell a governor's tear. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. Even President Wilson held up the day, but even he would fail. For nobody heard the soul-searching words of the soul in the Salt Lake City jail. Of the soul in the Salt Lake City jail. For 36 years he lived out his days, and he more than played his part. For the songs that he made, he was carefully paid, with a rifle bullet buried in his heart. With a rifle bullet buried in his heart. Yes, they lined Joe Hill up against the wall, blindfold over his eyes. It's the life of the rebel that he chose to live. It's the death of the rebel that he died. It's the death of the rebel that he died. In his time in the cell, he wrote to his friends, his wishes all were plain. My body can't be found on the Utah ground, so they laid him on a fast parting train. Yes, they laid him on a fast parting train.
And the rebel rode to Chicago town. There were 30,000 people to mourn. And just about the time that Jolie died, legend was just being born. A legend was just being born. Now some say Joe was guilty as charged. Some say he wasn't even there. And I guess nobody will ever know, 'cause the court records all disappeared. 'Cause the court records all disappeared. Say wherever you go in this fair land, in every Union hall, in the dusty dark, these words are marked in between all the cracks on the wall. In between all the cracks on the wall. It's the very last lines that Joe Hill wrote when he knew that his days were through. Boys, this is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Good luck to all of you.
And that concludes our show for today. Thanks to Jan Hocken, Denise Morris, and Norm Diamond for their contributions. A special thanks to our guest, Jennifer Ruth. And as always, a shout out to the staff who keep the gears oiled at KBOO. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Catch us again next Monday morning for a special Thanksgiving Indigenous-focused show, including a KPFK-produced segment featuring Lana Jack speaking about Google's proposed data center in the Gorge. I'm going to leave you with a song by Joe Hill called The Preacher and the Slave, sung here by Utah Phillips. Thanks for listening.
A long-haired preacher's come out every night. I try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by, in that glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you die, that's a lie. The starvation army, they play, and they shout and they clap and they pray. When they got all your coins on the drum, they will tell you when you're on the bum. You will eat by and by, in that glorious land in the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you